Okay, so I think today I want to talk about two things. One is a more in-depth look into a particular topic called pointing and navigation. And the second part, I want to talk about interaction and an interaction model that I call instrumental interaction. And so the goal here is to give you sort of more in-depth knowledge about what I would qualify both fundamental and more low-level topic on pointing, and the second part will be on something higher level, but also in a sense fundamental, or at least a little bit theoretical, about how to create interaction. So if the slide will move, that will help me a great deal. I mean, we're not Friday the 13th, right? There's no good reason why everything should go wrong today. Okay, this is frozen again. I guess I should have killed everything else. Okay, I'm going to talk about pointing, about Fitts' law, which I've talked about a little bit, about whether we can beat Fitts' law, and I'll try to spend enough time on other aspects of pointing that involve navigation, like multiscale pointing. So, I don't need to explain that pointing is important, I hope. I hope you realize that you spend most of your time on the computer pointing at things. Have you realized that? Yes? So, if I could come up with a way to make every pointing action just 10% faster, I would save millions of hours of people's time. So it's an important subject. It's also an important subject because the context in which we do these elementary tasks is changing. It's not just a desktop computer where you use a mouse. It's also your smartphone where you use your, fat finger. We call them fat relative to the size of the pixels. At the opposite, we have more and more large screens where you are very small compared to the screen. And the thing is, there are many things where you use computers and the performance is limited by the computer. And if you had a faster computer, you could do things faster. But for pointing, the problem is not really the computer or not just the computer. You can have the super fastest computer you want. Pointing performance is limited by your own motor abilities. So it's primarily an issue of how the human can communicate information to the system about what it is he or she wants to point. So, of course, we are interested in situations where the computer does not know what we want to point. Because if the computer knew, I wouldn't have to point in the first place. If it could, you know, read my mind or guess or etc. So I'm interested, this is really an input task, in the way I defined it earlier, in that I want to tell the computer something that it doesn't know in advance. So, the reason I decided to add this piece in the course is because pointing is probably one of the very few areas, I would argue probably the only area, where we have a strong theory of the human side of the behavior. And this theory was really created by Paul Fitts in the 1950s. And as I've explained before, he was interested in looking at the trade-off between speed and precision. If I ask you to do something very fast, you're likely to be less precise than if I tell you you have all the time you want. When you point at an object, it is a trade-off between speed and precision. You want to get to the target as fast as possible, but if the target is very small, and if there are a bunch of other targets around it, you want to be precise, because if you miss the target, it's going to be an error, and you're going to have to recover from that error. And Fitz studied this. Fitz was not a computer scientist. He was not interested at all in human-computer interaction. HCI didn't exist in 1954. Computers barely existed. Computers where you would point on the screen were not really in existence yet. So he was working in an aerospace lab, and he was really looking at pointing physically on the table, as the description of his apparatus is shown here. Around this time, also, Claude Shannon was developing information theory. And I think I've asked that before, but how many of you have heard of information theory? Okay. How many of you have had a class in information theory? Okay. Some who have never heard about it have had a class? Or did I miss something here? Anyway, so for those of you who don't know, information theory was a major breakthrough in telecommunication. We wouldn't have networks and probably very different computers today without information theory. And what Claude Shannon was looking at is when you have a channel, a wire, really, that transmits information, electric signals, and you want to shove the signals into digital information, what is the maximum capacity of that channel? How much information, how many bits per second can you transmit on that channel? And the reason there is a limitation in the first place is because channels are noisy. You put a signal at one end of the wire, if you measure it at the other end, there's noise added to it. And intuitively, the more noise you have on the channel, the less information you are going to be able to transmit per second. For a given amount of noise, there is a limit to this capacity. And to Paul Fitz, this was an inspiration for looking at the pointing task. And when you think of it, it's kind of a leap of thought. There's not very much in common between sending signals on wires and someone pointing at a target on the table. But the way he looked at it is, when I'm pointing at a target, I'm in fact transmitting information, I'm delivering information. And in the same way as you have this notion of noise in the information theory, or communicating a signal, when you pick at the target, the way to think about it is your target is infinitely small, but you allow yourself some tolerance. So in your movement, the control of your movement to reach the target, you allow yourself some noise. So if you don't land exactly on the target, it's still good enough. And of course, the larger the target corresponds to having a system with a lot of noise, and therefore a smaller capacity. And the way to think of the capacity here is that if I have a given size of my table, how many different targets can I put on that table? Well, if the targets are very small, of course, I can put many more targets. And the task of selecting one of these targets will require a lot more information. If I have a lot of noise, if I can't control my arm very well and I need large targets, then what happens is I can put only very few targets on my table, and that corresponds to a lower capacity of my system. So this notion of index of difficulty that Paul Fitz came up with is very much linked to the developments of information theory that were happening at the time. And he did something that is brilliant, but as many things that are brilliant and simple, they are not recognized as brilliant because they are obvious after the fact. And what he did is he operationalized this target acquisition task with this reciprocal pointing task. And on the table, he has two metallic parts here representing the target. He has this metallic pen hooked up with a wire so that when you touch, it poses a circuit and the system can measure very precisely the time it takes to go from one target to the next. And if you cut outside the target, it doesn't register, so it means you haven't acquired the target. So the target width operationalizes the tolerance, and the target distance operationalizes the amplitude of the movement, which is a notion of how much information you want to transmit. So his theory, his hypothesis, was that the time to move would reflect the amount of information you have to produce with your body movements. And so it would be proportional to what he called the index of difficulty of the task. And in his original formulation, the index difficulty was 2 times the target distance divided by W. The way to read this, in fact, is D over half of W. Because if you think of the actual target between the being the infinitely thin line in the middle here, the amount of noise, which is the target size, would be half of W on one side and half of W on the other side. So this 2D over W is really D over W over 2. Make sense? It's not very important. It's just to say that this did not come out of the blank. He didn't wake up in the middle of the night and saw this equation. He didn't measure things and then figure that, oh, this fits nicely, so here it goes. It was grounded in some theoretical analysis. So his hypothesis is that the time, the movement time, should be proportional to this index of difficulty, which is measured in bits, because you have D over W, that's a ratio without any unit, because it's inches over inches, or meters over meters, or 2 distances, so unitless ratio, and when you take the log in base 2 of a ratio, you can say, well, this is a unitless measure that we call bits. And so, if his theory is right, then the time, the movement time to get from one target to the other should be proportional to this index of difficulty. Or said another way, the ratio ID over MT should be a constant. And in fact, it's, the reason I put it this way is because ID is in bits, movement time is in seconds, bit per second. That's the equivalent of the capacity of a channel, how many bits per second you can get through the channel. And so this constant, if it is indeed a constant, would be the capacity of the human motor system to transmit information. So it's very, I think, enlightening to think of communicating with a computer as transmitting information. I mean, I know today it seems, we hear this all the time. But here, it's done in a way that is actually grounded in real theory of information. So when you are entering information in the computer, you can actually measure the capacity of your channel. So here's the original table that comes from Paul Fitt's paper. The paper is most cited, because of course he wrote more than one. And so here we had the W, the width, A, the amplitude. Here is computing the index of difficulty. And you see, in terms of number of bits, it's not very much. It goes from 1 here to the maximum 7. And then here is measured the time. It is that with 2 types of pens. So 1 ounce, it's a very light one, and the 1 pound one, a very heavy one. Because there's this notion that, of course, if the thing is heavier, it's going to be harder to move. But in fact, if you look at the times, they're not that different. And in fact, a lot of people think that the reason for Fitts' law is the capabilities of our motor system, of our muscles, of our joints, etc. No, it's not. It's really the whole system of perceiving the information, where is the target, and approaching it, and controlling your movement as you approach it. It's this feedback loop that you perform without thinking, of course, when you reach for an object. That's where the information processing happens. Now, we'll see in a minute, there are issues with your physical abilities, and Fitts' law is in fact only valid within certain limits. So if you take this and you do the plot, if you want to test your hypothesis that the relationship is linear, you plot the movement time against the index of difficulty, and here's his data. The triangle, so you see here the plot for small width, middle size, bigger and larger width. You know that when you have a thing like this, you can measure the quality of the regression, how close the points are on the thing. And typically it doesn't say here, do I have it here? No. But it's usually 0.95, so something, you know, extremely high. A lot of results that you find in studies in the medical sciences or things like this, if you have an R-square that is, you know, over 0.5, really, people are happy. 0.95 is something that you get very rarely in actual human processes. So this is a remarkable result, is what I want to say. And it says that here the index of performance, so this ID over NT I was talking about, is about 10 bits per second. So you're able to communicate 10 bits per second of information when you do what is called aimed movements, movements where you aim at the target. And he looked at velocity profiles to try to understand how the movement works. And the typical velocity profiles you get are these, is that you have an initial phase where you start moving very fast, of course, and then you adjust. And when you adjust, you have typically this bounces here where you slow down and speed up and slow down. Now the thing is, the fact that this pointing movement follow this very strong law that is inspired by information theory, in a sense it does not explain anything. It doesn't explain how our brain and motor system and perceptual system work to perform the gestures. It only observes the result and say, well, it's consistent with an explanation based on information theory. If you look in the literature, you'll find a number of papers that have tried and you know, people have worked all their lives trying to understand and have several models of how this works in the body. But in a sense, as an HCI researcher or practitioner, you're not so much interested in how it works in the human body if you have a strong model of how it behaves. You know, if you're a psychologist, yes, you may want to try to understand even more deeply how it works. Now, if you look in the literature, you'll find plenty of papers that reference Fitts' work. McKenzie is probably the person who's brought Fitts' law into HCI and has done the most work on it. He is the one who actually turned what's called the Fitts formulation of the law that he had initially into what is called the Shannon formulation. So, you know, if you look at this and say, well, I'm going from 2D over W to D over W plus 1, what the hell is that? Well, the D over W plus 1 is so that if the width of the target becomes very large and becomes as large as the distance, you don't end up with a log of zero, which is an annoying thing, or log of a value under one, which would be negative, because negative time is not a good thing. So this is just a little trick to make it more consistent with the eventual formulation of Shannon and avoid things at the limit. But this versus this is not very different when you look at ratios of D over W that are interesting. We're not interested in large targets. If your target is almost as large as the distance to the target, it's not interesting. We're interested in small targets or targets that are very far away. So D over W is only interesting if it's, you know, I would say 3, 4, or 5, or I mean, if the log is 2, 3, 4, or 5 at least. There are other formulations, and in a sense, again, this thing is not that important. What's important is that it's always D over W that is the determinant. And one way to look at this is to say, well, it's a scale invariant. Pointing an object at that is 1 centimeter wide at 50 centimeter takes exactly the same time as pointing an object that is 2 centimeters wide that is at 1 meter. And it's exactly the same time as pointing an object that is half a centimeter wide that is 25 centimeters. So if you change D and W in the same proportion, the time is going to stay the same, which is remarkable. So the essence of this is that movement time is a linear, or actually affine relationship of the index of difficulty, and the index of difficulty is a monotonic function of D over W. Then, you know, you can argue for years about these different formulations and find cases where one works better than the other, but at the sort of deep level, it's not important. Now, there are many scale invariant laws in nature, and there is one that is well known in psychology, which is that if you have a larger amplitude of movement, then there's also larger variability of that movement. So think of animals that flap their wings. Right? So if you think of a fly is pretty small and has very small wings. It flaps the wings with a small amplitude, and if you measure it, it has a very small variability. If you think of, a big
albatross.
What did you have?
Eagle.
I was going to say pterodactyl. So, very big wing, larger amplitude, and larger variability. So it's something that is kind of intuitively normal that if you are controlling a larger amplitude of a movement, you will have less precision. So this scale invariant is actually something that we find in many cases in natural phenomena. Now, of course, if I continue my scale invariance, I'm going to run into problems. So I said, you know, a target is 1 centimeter wide at 50 centimeters is the same at 2 centimeters at 1 meter. Would be the same as, I don't know, a 1 meter target at, 50 meters away or something? So now, if I put a target 50 meters away, and I make it a meter wide, you really think that it's going to take you the same time as the target is a centimeter, 50 centimeters away? No. Why?
The law is true as long as you stay at the human scale.
Yeah, don't read the slide.
No, I didn't.
Well, you know, 50 meters is still human scale. I still can get there. I mean, I could have taken the size of the universe and then... But why? I mean, yes, we know that if it gets very large, it's not going to work intuitively. If the target gets very small, you know, 1 nanometer, we're probably going to run into trouble as well. So yes, there are limits. So I'm thinking now of the upper part of the scale. If my target's at 50 meters, how do I get there?
Well, these are different motor skills. The one 15 centimeters, you will use your arms, and
yeah.
15 meters is the legs. So.
Yeah, so you have to walk.
Yeah.
Or run.
Right.
Now, if you remember, there's a curve profile here. The time it takes is actually the area under the curve. Now, there is an assumption that I can go as fast as I need before I start slowing down. But this is not true if I start running. I cannot run, you know, as fast as needed until I need to start slowing down. So if I have a ceiling on my velocity, well, then I have a part here with a, what we call a plateau, something horizontal, that is going to be as long as needed until I get to the target. And because of this plateau, then the time it takes to get there gets directly proportional to the distance. You know, if I put a target 50 meters away from here, whether I make it 1 centimeter big or 1 meter big, it's not going to change very much the time it takes you to get there. It will change a bit the very last pointing movement, but the time will be dominated by the time it takes to run there. So when you go to very large amplitudes or distances, the limitation comes from the fact that we cannot move ourselves infinitely fast. As soon as you reach a ceiling in the speed, Fitts' law is going to start, it's going to stop working. Now, if we go to smaller, to the other end of the spectrum, so very small width, well, we get into the issue of what is the accuracy of your motor control. How small can you move your hand? Well, do you have an idea?
1 millimeter.
1 millimeter?
Half a millimeter?
Tenth of a millimeter.
Tenth of a millimeter.
With which device?
Oh, with your hand on the table. I haven't put a computer in the system yet. So if you are on your, I don't know, imagine you are a surgeon or
watchmaker.
Maybe it depends if you can see the target.
Yes?
So if you can zoom like a surgeon, maybe you can move more precisely.
Yes. And watchmakers use magnifiers as well. So that's right. In fact, our ability to control our movement exceeds our visual acuity. And this is why people like, in these two examples, surgeons or watchmakers, use magnifying glasses, because they can control more than what they can see. We ran an experiment a long time ago that was using a tablet that had a resolution of 300 dots per inch. And we could actually reach that resolution with the hand, if you magnified the movement on the screen. So your human motor control is extremely fine with your hand, of course. So, you know, if you go to a fraction of a millimeter, so a tenth of a millimeter is actually not a bad sort of ballpark. If you go below that, again, it's not that the time is going to grow linearly like we saw for the distance. It's just you won't be able to do it reliably, so it's going to be hit and miss. So this means that the ratio D over W is bounded by a factor of about 2,000. Right? So the ID in any meaningful task for a human being with an arm, or an arm plus upper body if you want to get a little bit more amplitude, is going to be about 12. Now, a lot of the work on fins has been done in the lab. So we saw the apparatus that FITS used. There is now, in fact, an ISO standard to test pointing devices or pointing techniques in a way that is consistent, so we can make comparisons. But these are all lab studies. Now, when I sit you behind the desk and I draw these two things on the table and I tell you point as fast as you can between these two targets, you know, this is not a very realistic task. And that's what we do a lot of the time when we do lab studies, is we take something and we make it so we eliminate external side effects, biases, and all sorts of things. And we concentrate on the thing we study, and the result is sometimes we get very nice results in the lab, and then when we go back to the real world, they don't really apply, because, you know, we did something that was not realistic enough. So this is a study that we did a few years back, where we looked at what we call pointing in the wild. So we created a program on both macOS, Windows, and Linux. Or at least macOS and Linux, I'm not sure about Windows. We asked people if they allowed us to install this on their computer, and that program was capturing their every movement with a mouse. And so we collected from 24 users about 2 million aimed movements that we could identify as such. I think we had, I don't know how many, thousands of miles of mouse moves. Yeah, here it is, a billion pixels, so 350 kilometers. And we started looking at the data. The data showed interesting things. So here is an example of one user, and we've mapped all his movements over, I don't know, something like, maybe this is just a day. It's clear that on this particular screen, there are hotspots, or places that the user hits more than others. So here, you know, you have this status bar at the bottom, so... this wasn't Linux, I think, so... here there are probably menus and things. The thing that was very difficult there was to distinguish what is an aimed movement from you're just moving your mouse around to find the cursor, or because you're bored, or you're scrolling through a document, which is a different kind of task. And so we did a lot of work to try to extract a subset of these movements that we were pretty sure were pointing movements. And then even though we could do that, there was still a question of, you know, well, but what was the target? If we don't know the target, we don't know the target size, and we cannot see how it works in terms of FITS law. So every time you clicked, we were in fact extracting a sort of snapshot of the screen, and later on we're trying to identify which target it was. And if we couldn't find a target, we just didn't count this in our analysis. And so here, what we ended up with, this is a plot of the index of difficulties of the task we've seen, so from under 1 to about 9, and the movement time. And if you take this and you slice it vertically and compute the median in each slice, you get these red dots, and the regression is pretty remarkable again. So on average, yes, pointing follows FITS law. There's another way to look at it, is, I mean, you see that this cloud sort of stops around here. There are points here that are probably outliers due to either the way we capture the data, the way we filtered what we thought were pointing movements or not. So, you know, these are very small number of samples here that are strange, because zero movement time means you're already on the target. So it shouldn't have an index of difficulty. So I don't know exactly what happened there. But if you look at sort of where the cloud stops, you have another regression that is also very nicely aligned. And this is essentially your limit of expert performance. It's the best you can do. Because we're bound by Fitts' law. I mean, it's not something that we can make without.
Is it even that, for example, Olympic sport people would rely on their feedback loop to perform, and does this still apply in Fitts' law? I mean,
you see differences. You have, if you are young and in good shape like you guys, you get, you know, better performance than older people or people with disabilities. If you look at the data for one user, you will get one very nice curve in most cases. And in fact, the reason why Fitts' law is so popular in human-computer interaction research is because this A, I wanted to show the equation here. Let me go. Yeah, this one. Here we have two constants, A and B. And these really allow you to compare different people or different pointing devices. If I now move to the computer, I ask you to point on the computer, and I give you a mouse, or I give you a trackpad, or I give you a track point, a mini joystick, or I give you, I don't know, some other input device point, I can compare the performance of these input devices by looking at the value of B for these different conditions, right? So, if you look user by user, you'll find little differences. The law is still there, the constant changes a little bit. If you use different devices, you will still get this nice regression, but you will be able to say, well, this device is better than this one because its curve is higher, is lower. Lower is better because the time is lower. Yes?
I'm interested to know like what the index of difficulty 9 task is like. What the task, what can a task like surround that?
Well, I don't know exactly for this where this came from, but try to think on the computer when you have difficult pointing tasks to make. If you try to, it said that on the earlier slide, if you try to set the cursor between two L's in a word, that is in font 10 in Word, you have about a 1 pixel wide space. If you have a fairly big screen, you know, I have a 30-inch screen on my desk, it's 2500 pixels. So a target of 1 pixel at even half of that, say 1,000 pixels, I get to a ratio of 1,000 to 1. That's about 2 to the power of 10. That's an idea of 10 bits. So you have 10-bit pointing tasks on standard pointing situations.
Window borders
are... I was going to say, the window borders are very thin. So what you'll find is Fitts' law has been used a lot to compare the performance of input devices. And this ISO standard that I was talking about, and I should probably add a slide on this at some point, was really designed to help people make comparable data sets about different devices. But I think there's an even better question to ask. Is can we beat Fitts' law? So the question there is, if you think of pointing in the real world, well, you know, you have a set of targets in the world and you ask to go to one or the other. If you put a computer there, what can the computer do for you? Can the computer help you point faster? Now, when I say, can we beat Fitts' law, it seems inconsistent with what I said before, that the reason that we have this strong relationship is because of our perceptual and motor control skills. We have this loop that we have to acquire information, we have to control our limbs, and we have to adjust in the feedback loop our motion to what we see or progress towards the target. Now, if the thing I'm pointing at can somehow change, if the link between my device, such as the mouse, and the cursor on the screen, you all know that on when you use a mouse, you have what's called mouse or cursor acceleration, which is not acceleration at all, we'll talk about it a bit. But if I can, you know, play some tricks in there, can I make it more efficient? Another question to ask is, if I'm pointing in a world of information, I'm going to the Library of Congress, they have something like, 100 million documents? If I'm looking for one document, I can quantify this as an index of difficulty. I have one document among 100 million. If I'm looking something on Google Maps and I'm zooming and panning and I'm looking for things, I can acquire targets. So, you know, I can start with a view of the Earth and then zoom down and click at something that is a few meters high wide, which is this building on Google Earth. You can, when you deal with information worlds, you quickly reach index of difficulties that are 20, 30. Now, 30 bits seems nothing in the world of gigabytes and terabytes, but an index of difficulty of 30 means a ratio of 2 to the power of 30 between the distance you have to cover and the size of the target. So can we expand the limits of validity of Fitts' law that we saw before were limited by our physical ability by changing the world within which they operate, which is not anymore the physical world, but is now the artificial world? Well, so let's see what we can do. Well, if I want to beat Fitts' law, one thing I can try to do is to reduce the index of difficulty. So for the same task, the same thing I'm trying to accomplish, make it so it has a smaller ID than in the original design. Now, because it's a ratio of D over W, I can either try to decrease distance or to increase width. Now, if you could make all targets on the screen 10 times bigger without them hiding each other, it would be a lot easier to play. But of course, intuitively, you see that this is not going to work because there are so many targets on the screen, we cannot make them bigger. Well, there are situations where the world is not that dense. So here's a technique called drag and pop by Patrick Bodish that reduces the distance. And the way it works is on a large display, say this is an interactive display and I have my desktop here, and I have this icon, the report, and I need to drag it there. Now, if I were on the display the size of this wall, I would have to start here and then move my cursor and my icon to the other end of the screen, and as soon as I start walking, you know, I'm not going to have a good performance. Well, so what he did is say, if you don't go to the targets will come to you. So when I start dragging, it looks in that direction, what are the potential targets. It uses knowledge that if I'm dragging a Word document, in that example, only a subset of the objects are potential targets. You know, Outlook is, well, maybe for an attachment, but Illustrator is really not a target for a Word document. So it's only bringing to me those targets, like the trash, Explorer, and of course Word itself, next to me. So I'm here, I start moving, and the targets come to me, and then I have a much smaller distance.
Now it works?
Yes, it works. As usual, I will see that with every example I'm going to give. There are some cases where it works very well, but there are also cases where it doesn't work at all. If I have many targets, when I bring them together next to me, well, they will crumple together. So what they do is they reorganize them. But if you reorganize them, you lose the spatial clues you have, so you have to do a search task. Now, I could do an entire other lecture on Hick's law, which is about searching, visual searching. And it's also a log formulation. The time it takes to look for an object in a set of n objects is proportional to the log of n. So if you save time in the pointing task, but you lose time in the visual search, overall it may be not a gain. So that's an example where, even though it doesn't work all the time, the fact that it works in a number of cases is interesting. Another example is the magic pointing by Shumin Jai. And here the idea is, or rather it's based on the observation that when people point, they tend to look at the target before they get to the target. It's very intuitive. Well, so what if we had an eye tracker? So I can know, the computer knows where you're looking. And if it sees that you're looking at a target and you're a target, it moves the cursor there immediately, rather than you having to do all the work of bringing it there. So this is another way of reducing distance traveled by the user. And it does work. But again, and that's true of every system I know that uses eye gaze in an active way, it's very spooky because the system is watching you and having the cursor jump, depending on where you look, well, sometimes you want to look at something to get there, but sometimes just to look at it. And so, yes, on a task that is operationalized, like Fitts' law, like when you have to go left and right, they show an advantage, a clear advantage. In real use, even though pointing is faster, some other tasks are slower. So, no magic answer here, despite the term, but it's a very clever approach.
I would like to know if this reminds me of a feature that I can see in Photoshop and other software. I want to know if it's actually related to this. Imagine that I have a square on top of a grid, and I want to resize the square, and I can make the grid to be sticky.
Yes.
So I know how to get exactly to the picture.
Yes.
I want to resize and sticks automatically.
Well, when you have this kind of a magnetic grid, what you do is you make a trade-off. And essentially, you've reduced the number of different distances. So yes, it affects your pointing performance, but at the expense of precision. But in cases where you don't want the precision, of course, it's a good idea. But yes, it can certainly be analyzed with that approach. So let me move on, because this is a subject again where I could spend a week. So other approach, well, here we decrease D. What about increasing W, making targets bigger? Now, as I said, if we make everything bigger, it's not going to work in areas where the targets are densely packed. So Michael McGuffin had this idea to only expand the targets as you approach them. And he ran an experiment on the expanding targets, where as the cursor gets close to here, the target expands, gets bigger. And what he showed is that the performance of pointing is defined not by the real size of the target, but by the expanded size. So if you make all targets get 4 times bigger when you push them, you gain 2 bits in your index of difficulty. And that's a very easy thing to do. Well, this is an interesting case where we looked at this paper and we thought there was a flaw. We thought that because targets were always expanding, people were saying, hey, I know the target is going to get bigger, so there's anticipation. Now, in the real world, if it were news, it's fine that you anticipate a behavior like the target growing by itself. But we're interested in knowing whether the gain was because you knew the target was going to get bigger or not. And so we ran a new experiment, the exact same design, except there was a random factor. I mean, not a random factor, but the factor that randomly decided whether to expand or not the target. So when you approached the target, you didn't know if it was going to get bigger or not. So you could not sort of pre-plan your gesture for a bigger or smaller target. And we were sure it would be different results. And it didn't. And that surprised us. So, and that's why you run experiments. When you're not looking for the experiments to give you the things you expect, it's boring. You're looking for an experiment to try to get a surprise, something that then you have to explain. I mean, I'm kidding. Sometimes it's nice to know that the experiment worked and you can move on to something else. But when you get something that is not what you expected, it's very intriguing. And what is said in this paper is that one thing they varied is the distance at which the target starts expanding. And even if the target expanded when you had covered 90% of the distance, you still had the effect. And this is why we thought that people were taking advantage of knowing the target was going to expand, because when you're so close to the target to take advantage of a change in size, it didn't make sense. But then we got back to looking at the velocity profiles. And in fact, if you look at this, we have to put it in a different form, but in fact, you spend the first 50% of the time covering the 90% of the distance, and you spend the other half of the time doing the final adjustment at the end. So he was looking in terms of distance. But in terms of time, when you are here, it's only halfway through your pointing time, which means it gives you plenty of time to adjust to a change in size of the target. And so this was an example where by replicating the experiment, we learned something that we didn't know. And at the same time as we were doing this, the Macintosh came out with the dock. So for those of you who don't know, the dock is this thing on the side. And it has this magnifying feature, which is when you approach it, so here I have it in the mode where it's hidden, but you can have it on all the time, and when you approach it, the icon gets bigger, and then you can move through it. And we showed that with this, you do not get the advantage that is predicted by expanding targets. So what is going on? I mean, we have here a concrete example of something that implements the principle we've studied, and it doesn't work. Well, it doesn't work because, unfortunately, there are no variables. Here's why. When you have densely packed targets, what you want is to enlarge a target. If you enlarge a target by hiding the one next to it, the system still doesn't know which one of these you're going to get to. It can only guess based on the angle of approach and things like this. So it has to make a guess. The way it works on the dock of the Mac is if I am right on the left edge of this cross icon here, I get these two icons enlarged the same, right? And in fact, I put this dotted line here to show that the left side of this big icon has not changed. This one has grown to the left, and this one to the right, and this one to the left. And same thing. And in fact, the whole thing has grown a little bit. Now imagine that I'm here. I'm in fact on the icon, but and I'm moving horizontally. What happens is as you move horizontally and you reach what was the original left right side of this, you get to this configuration, where now this icon is the same size as this one, and I'm on the right-hand side of this. So even though the icon was very big, it was slipping under my feet. And you can see this very well here, where, you know, I'm here, the limit between Evernote and LiveScribe. As I'm moving down, Evernote is moving up. So when I get to the limit to text edit, the number of pixels I've covered with my cursor is exactly the same as if I didn't have expansion. And that to us was a revelation, because it made us discover that there are two things at work here. There is the visual size. Yes, the cursor is bigger. You can't deny that. But there's also the motor size of the target. Seen from your mouse, that thing is not any bigger. You understand why? It's what I had in my drawing here. Seen from the cursor, going from here to here, I've covered the whole width of this target that is not expanded. But in the expanded mode, going from here to here, I've covered also all of my target, even though it's way bigger. Because as I was moving right, it was moving left, and vice versa. So I have two things going on. The things I see, and they are important because they help me guide my movement, and the things that the cursor sees, in a way, or the space in which I produce my movement. Yes?
So if you would slow down the cursor as soon as you arrive at your target point, you would get the same like relative size of the pointer to the icon. So you would gain just that precision that you lost by slipping the symbols, wouldn't you?
Yes. And that's where we're getting to.
The reason why it works, I think it's because visual feedback helps you a little bit.
No.
You don't think...
We've run the experiment. You don't point faster.
You don't point faster.
You don't point faster.
And is it worse?
It's not worse either. It's pretty much neutral. I mean, you know, you can, if you want to do things well, there's the effect of the angle to which you arrive, which can change things. The error rates may change a little bit, but overall, no. But we're going to get to something where it does work. So here's another case where we did a quick study of extending the size of target. And that's the case when the targets are on the side of your screen. Because if the target is on the side of the screen, it is effectively semi-infinite. Because all you need, and I use this that example, if you recall, with the menus. If I hit a menu which is at the top of the menu, the menu bar at the top of the screen, I can throw my cursor, and as long as I've hit the menu item in the horizontal dimension, you know, the cursor is blocked at the top, so it's going to hit the target. So we compared various techniques, and we showed, in fact, that indeed, you take advantage of this semi-infinite target size on an interface like the Mac, where the menu bar is right at the top. Interestingly, it's different at the top and the bottom, and that's purely due to the shape of the cursor, because the cursor is an arrow pointing towards the top, so when you go to the top of the screen, you still see the arrow. When you go to the bottom, the arrow disappears, and so you lose the cursor. So we did something where when you get to the bottom, the cursor flips and works better. What we also did is look at the effect of the angle of attack again, and there's various tricks you can play to do things. But what we also discovered is that the visual has a lot of importance. So when people see those icons, as you see those icons, there's room between the icon and the side. Now, if I click here, I will still start this thing. So the actual area of the target goes to the left side, but people see this icon and they feel compelled to point to that icon. You have the same thing with the taskbar in Windows. If you go to the bottom, I think now it works if you are right at the bottom, but you feel like you are out of the button. And so even though we know that people take advantage of the borders, a lot of and even though the systems are designed in that way, just the visual aspect doesn't give users the right clue that they can actually bump on the side. So that's another aspect of increasing target size, taking advantage of size. And then we get into the very hairy issue of transfer functions. Now, as I said before, with indirect devices, when you have a mouse or a trackpad, something where it's not directly pointing on the surface. So when you have indirect pointing, you can play all sorts of tricks, because there is no reason that the displacement of the mouse by 1 centimeter should displace the cursor by 1 centimeter. It could depend on the speed, and that's what mass acceleration is. These are curves that have been extracted by my colleagues from Lille, Jérôme Cazier and Nicolas Roussel. And they, this is from Windows, this is from OS X with a mouse. And this is the gain that is applied to your movement as a function of the speed at which you move the mouse. So what is mouse acceleration? First, don't call it mouse acceleration, or know that it's not an acceleration at all. But anyway, mouse acceleration is the idea that if, imagine this is my mouse, and this is my mouse pad. If I'm going to travel along my mouse pad, if I do it slowly, the cursor maybe is going to cross half the screen. If I do the same motion, same amplitude of the motion, but faster, the cursor is going to go much further away. That means that what we call the gain, the ratio between the mouse motion and the cursor motion, is not fixed. It depends on the speed. Now, why something where displacement depends on speed was called an acceleration, I don't know. But and so this is what these curves tell us. Now, what's striking about these curves is that they are weird. I mean, on Windows, you have this bump here. And why is there a bump at 0.1 meter per second? Nobody knows. On OS X, it's even worse, because not only there is a bump, but then there is a maximum, and then slow. So up to here, the faster you go, the faster your cursor goes, but then it's not true anymore. And then you have this one, which has this bump here in the middle that nobody knows where it came from. I think some engineer screwed up, or some table was with, anyway. Now, there was very early on in the 80s an experiment that was trying to measure the effect of this mass acceleration. It was done by Stu Carr, who was a very serious scientist, and he found no effect on pointing performance. Which is counterintuitive, because you think you point faster, right? Well, in fact, not, because it's fast to cross the screen, but then you need more time to adjust. So what you gain in the sort of what we call the ballistic side of the thing by going faster in the beginning, you pay for it later on by the adjustments. Now, this colleague from Lille, Jerry Casier, has redone these studies, and the thing is the mice at the time were not very precise. Now we have mice, especially for gamers, that have this very, very high CPI. CPI is a counts per inch, how many the resolution of the mouse. And if you look at the graphs, then you can see an effect of the curve. So we know we can actually use these transfer, they're called transfer functions, to improve pointing performance. Now we're still not beating Fitts' law. We're still, you know, driven by Fitts' law. It's just we're lowering the curve a little bit, or the regression. You had a question.
It's related to game.
Yes.
And this is a nightmare for a gamer because all this, when you want to have a lot of precision, you need to remove all the software acceleration,
yes,
all the mouse acceleration, and you start improving your aim by using larger pads or better mouse with larger DPI.
Yeah.
But this is not helpful.
No, and I mean, you know, he's done a lot of work on this, and I give it on your slide here. He has found a measurable effect of pointer acceleration, but also the curves you have in current systems are not optimal. That's the short story. But the thing I really want to get to is this one, because this is, I think, what your conclusion was. Because I think this notion that the space in which you move your input device, whether it's a mouse or, again, a trackpad or even a joystick, and the visual space is very powerful. Which also says, if you take it the other way around, that when your input space and visual space are the same, like on a tablet or an interactive table, you are, in fact, limited by the fact that the interaction is direct. The fact that we put this indirection, which allows us to play games with this transfer function, is in fact very powerful. And so even though a tablet is very compelling because it's direct interaction, in fact, a number of things that we can do with indirect interaction we cannot, or we haven't found a way to do on a direct device. So this is semantic pointing, which was done by my former student, Renaud Blanc. And it's really clever. And it's not because he's my student that said that, because it was his idea. In fact, we were working with EPR on this. And the idea is to say, well, let's explicitly give two sizes to each target. A visual size, the size you see, and a motor size, the size that your mouse sees. So the idea is, here's a dialog box. Here's what it looks like on the screen. Here's what it looks like on your mouse pad. And as you can see, things that are not clickable or very interesting, like the title, the message itself, are not interesting from the input perspective. Of course, you want to be able to read them. But in terms of input size, we can shrink them. Now, the most likely option, which is saved here, we want to make much bigger to make it easier. We increase target size, make it easier. The dangerous option, don't say, we make a lot smaller. So you have to work harder to get there. Now, the whole magic of the thing is that you see this, your mouse sees that, and you're not aware of what's going on.
So if you click a console, you click instead, right?
No. That's the thing. Okay, right before I was talking about these transfer functions, and I was saying mouse acceleration is about changing the gain according to your speed. Here I'm doing something even more clever. I'm changing the gain according to where you are. So say your cursor is here to start with. to go to the save button in the motor space, I have a small distance. Here I have a larger distance. So as I move towards the save button, my cursor is going to go faster. I have mouse acceleration, not based on my speed, but based on where I am. To go there, I'm going to slow down the cursor. It's going to take more effort. Now, it's very hard to explain, and even when I'm going to show you, you're not going to see anything, which is the beauty of it. We could apply this to scroll bars. Scroll bars are big, not because you want to look at them. In fact, you don't want to look at them. They're big so you can click at them. So let's make them small visually, but large in the motor space. So I had an applet. I said I had because I had to reboot this damn machine, and so I don't know how long it's going to take me to find it again. So I'm going to try, actually it's here, it's not so bad. No, it is not here. Oh. It has this way of putting windows in the most hidden places. Oh, here it is. Now, if you look for Renault Blanc, you can find this applet online. It's on its website. So here, what do we have? On the left, we have an image of a desktop. So there's a large window here. OK, well, that's, oh, I see. So we have a window. I can move it by its title. I have a resize box. I can enlarge it. I have icons that I can move. On the right is what your mouse sees. So imagine that what you have on the right is what's on your mouse pad. So here I don't have a semantic pointing enabled. So as you can see, the motion, don't forget the bottom part. The motion in the left and in the right is exactly the same. Now I'm going to enable semantic pointing. And here's what happens as I approach. So look on the left. On the left, I'm approaching this resize box. On the right, as I approach it, it gets bigger. So the target has gotten bigger and easier to grab. Now, of course, in the real life, I wouldn't see what's happening on the right. I would only see what's happening on the left. What's happening on the left, and you cannot see it unless you are moving the cursor yourself, is that as I get closer to this, my cursor slows down. So if I try to do a regular motion to go across that widget here, when I approach it and when I'm on it, the gain is smaller. And that gives the effect that the target is larger. Same thing with icons here. Same thing with the menu bar.
And can you feel it when you do it?
So here's the story. We ran an experiment. Our theory was, our hypothesis was that the size that counts is the motor size, not the visual size. And we validated this 100%. If you look at the Fitts law, I didn't put the diagrams, but if you use the motor size as the W in the index of difficulty, you get perfect regression. If you use the visual size, you don't get as good a regression. And then we asked the subjects, and none of them realized that something was going on. Now, is that good or bad? And they all performed better, but they didn't notice.
Good.
I think it's perfect. I'm not sure it makes for a good marketing argument. but to me, it's pretty good. It's remarkable that this manipulation of the gain of the transfer function was effective and completely unnoticed. And then IGEA pushed that to the limit. And they said, well, why do we even have to move the cursor in this empty space in terms of input? And so you created object pointing, where the cursor can only skip from one target to the next. So you are in say the title bar, and if you move towards the save button, it jumps in. Now, I'm proud to report that this is the only case I know where we have actually beaten Fitzel. We did a Fitz pointing, reciprocal pointing task, and we had constant pointing time. Hooray! Well, of course, because in the task there's only two targets, so when you are on one, you can only go on the other one. So if you jump to the target immediately, yes, you get constant point in time. Now, so that was the thing we emphasized in the paper. Now we also created a little interface, like sort of the one I showed you before, with object pointing, and performance was not as good because, of course, if you move in the right direction and you land immediately on the target you want, it's great. But if you miss the target, then you have to do another pointing. And in densely packed areas, you ended up really having the sense of losing control because it was hard to control where the thing was going.
So does it visually also jump? Do I not see it moving from the one button to the next?
I think one issue we did is that we did not have an animation. So it did jump there immediately and highlight the target. So I'm sure there's more work to do on this, because this is really cool.
Maybe the point is that the user is planning his motor movement. So in the real life, you expect to need some time to reach a target.
Yes.
So
there is this notion of the feedback loop, and you can... Yes. There are many things going on, but this is why it's interesting, because up to what extent can you manipulate the user, in a sense? But the interesting thing is that object pointing is a limit case of semantic pointing. So in semantic pointing, I could very easily have a slider that makes the thing where it behaves from a completely normal interface to an object pointing interface at the other extreme, and you could select in between. I want to get moving. I think this is my last pointing example. There are many pointing techniques, but this one is a very clever one as well. It's called bubble cursor. So it's the best technique known today. Although all these techniques in densely packed areas, they just get down to the basic Fitz law because there's nothing you can do. All these techniques take advantage of the fact that some pixels on the screen are unused in terms of pointing. So how do we take advantage of this? Bubble cursor works as follows. Here is your cursor. And as you move the cursor, it has a cursor area, this circle, that grows and gets smaller according to the landscape around it. And in fact, what it does, it's going to grow just enough to enclose the closest target. Which means that when you are in this empty space, when there is no target, and you click, you will always catch a target. And you always catch the closest one. The way this works is, I don't know if you're familiar with Delaunay triangulation and the Voronoi diagrams. If I have a set of dots here, let's assume the targets are just simple dots. I can create a tiling of the space where all the points in that tile here are those that are closer to this target than to any other target. And the way you do this is you draw the graph linking each target to the closest ones, and you take the medians of these. So, and then they intersect, and there are all sorts of fantastic properties. If you do computer graphics, you will We will deal with that, and not only like this, but in 3D, so good luck. So what it means is that when my cursor, so if I imagine that given my set of targets, I compute this tiling of the space, for each point, I know which is the closest target. So all I have to do is to grow the cursor to enclose that target. Now that increases performance because again we increase target width and we increase it to the maximum possible since every point on the screen is assigned to a particular target. So I think I have, so one problem however is that in many interfaces you have targets but you also want to be able to point at an individual point on the screen, you know, if you're drawing a rectangle or things like this. So we worked on an extension of this called DynaSpot that combines the bubble cursor with a regular cursor. And so the video I'm going to show you is this. So where is it? DynaSpot. Now one thing that is very annoying with the bubble cursor is that the bubble keeps moving and growing and shrinking and so visually, it's not the best design. Okay, so here what we've put is a target with distractors, and this is a pure area cursor. I need to find the example. So this is what's called an area cursor. The disk is fixed size and you just have to overlap one target and click. So that's what we call the baseline. This is the DynaSpot technique where you will see that the cursor size, it's hard to see, changes. Here it's a bigger cursor. I'm sorry, this is not very... I thought I had a better... okay, here's the bubble cursor, and that, I think, will be more explanatory. So, you see? Now, visually, it's kind of annoying, I must say. But it's quite powerful, because if you have one target, you only have to cross half the distance. Well, I'm sure you...
If the target is
IAT. Yeah. Well, I've seen other works where they've tried to change the visual, not doing a bubble, but just a link to the target itself. It still kind of jumps all over the place. And the thing is that this triangulation of it's showing, you sort of have to have it in your head to anticipate how it works. If you show that thing, I'm not sure it's going to help really. So what we've done in DynaSpot is bound the size of the bubble. It's not ideal either. But I think, you know, if you combine this notion of semantic pointing, where you can decouple visual size from motor size, and use the concept of the bubble cursor so that there's a notion of empty space, and when you're in empty space, you can immediately target the closest target, you can get something very powerful. It hasn't been yet sort of synthesized into the ultimate pointing technique, but it could be interesting to go there. Now, are we done? No. If you look at the research in this area, we've seen two types of approach. One called target agnostic. They don't need to know where the targets are. So pointer acceleration doesn't need to know that there are targets. All the techniques where there is significant gain, however, are target aware. They need to know where the potential targets are. So we know they are more efficient, but they also rely on knowledge of what the targets are. And this is not always clear. I mean, yes, buttons are targets, menus are targets, etc. But when you are drawing, what is a target, what isn't, is less clear. So there is a debate there in the community of whether we should push this idea of target-aware techniques or try to have target-agnostic one that gives us better results. There's also another trend that is very interesting, which is to learn from the user. And by using, I show you this graph where we collected data, and we saw these points where things were seemed to aggregate. Well, if you think of semantic pointing, I could start my interface with visual size equal motor size, but then the more I click on the target, the more important it becomes. And I could learn what targets are and what interesting targets are dynamically, rather than having the interface designer make the decisions. So this is an area where there's hundreds of papers published on this, and there's still a lot of work to do on something as simple as pointing. And that's not all, because we've only looked here at techniques where I try to improve pointing in sort of normal desktop interfaces. But the next question can I beat those limits of 12 bits, distance about 1 meter, I mean 2 meters if you have long arms, and width, I put half a millimeter here, because even though you can go to 0.1, the performance starts getting really not very good. Well, in 94, Ken Perrin and invented this notion of zoomable interface. Now, this was in 1994. Now, today we have Google Earth and Google Maps, a bunch of zoomable things out there, so it's not very new. But at the time, it was it was really a new perspective on how to build interfaces that deal with large data. In one of the examples, they had this thing where there's the word calendar, and you had a way to zoom on it. As you zoom it, you start seeing the years, and then if you zoom enough, the word calendar itself disappears. Then when you zoom on 1 year, you see the month of the year, and so on and so forth, until you can see the calendar itself. So instead of navigating through discrete steps, where I go from month to day to hours to etc., here you have a continuous zoomable space. They had a thing like this with a story that goes into a tree where you can zoom in and zoom in and zoom in to get more and more detail. Well, that's interesting, because when you have a zoomable space, the notion of target of pointing is sort of renewed, because you have targets that can be infinitely small, distances that can be infinitely large. And yet you're still doing this on screen, so you don't have to get out and run to get to the other side of the world. You can traverse the world on your computer. So Furness and Biederson did a subsequent version of PAD called PAD++, and worked with George Furness on this notion of space scale diagrams, which is a way to understand what is going on in the zoomable world. And it's not easy, because we are not used to think of zooming. We don't zoom the real world. We move in the real world, and so if I want more detail, if I'm here, I can't really see what's on my computer. If I want more detail, I have to get close to it, and then I get more detail. But with a zoomable interface, it's kind of the opposite. I'm standing here, and I say, wow, I can see this. Why don't I stretch it so it gets bigger? So our intuitions are not necessarily right. And they introduce these space scale diagrams that allow us to understand how we navigate in a zoomable world. So imagine this world where I have this word zoom here written very big. And my viewing window is there on the bar to Z, and I want to go to the M. But of course, I can only see this. So I can only see this, and I want to get there. Well, of course, what you can do is zoom out to get context, and then zoom back into the area of interest. So you will get out, here you do some panning, and then you can zoom in. In a space scale diagram, you have a 2D plane, XY, and a scale dimension. As I go up the scale dimension, the same image gets bigger and bigger. And the way to visualize multi-scale navigation is that my viewing window is the same size. So if I'm high up in the scale dimension, I see only a detail. Same window, I move it down, I get overview. And so a zooming interface allows you to navigate by typically zoom out, pan, zoom in. Now with that, I can get from any point on the Earth, if I think of Google Maps, to any other point quite efficiently. And we did an experiment with India about this. And so we had a zooming interface. And we were testing indices of difficulties, you can see here, that were going up to 30. That's 2 to the power of 30 between the size of the distance to the target and the size of the target. We equated this to you are standing in Jardin du Luxembourg in Paris. I mean, you can also stand in outside the building here. And you want to go to New Zealand. Pick a particular flower in whatever central park they have there. That's, if the flower is about a centimeter big, that's about the idea of the task here. Now, if you were to do this for real, it would take you a couple of days. I mean, if you have your own plane, you can probably do it in less than a day. If you do this on Google Earth, takes you maybe 20 seconds. What we showed is with a pan and zoom interface, even though what you're doing is extremely different from the traditional pointing task where I just move my hand towards where I want to go, here I have to zoom out, I have to zoom in while panning, etc. When we were in that part of the spectrum here, we were doing pure pointing. Then around here, there's this transition where you have to start zooming, and here you have to zoom. And we got this amazing curve here that shows that Fitt's law still applied, even though you were doing a motion that is completely unnatural and extremely different from the traditional pointing.
But how do you evaluate the length of a zoom then? So if you have to calculate the distance.
Aha. Well, remember, we have this scale invariant. What we care about is d over w. So as long as I measure distance and width at the same scale, d over w is invariant whether I measure it here or here or here. So going 10,000 kilometers to pick a target of 1 centimeter is the same thing as going 1 meter and picking a target of one, I don't know if it's micrometer or whatever. So it's just because we are in a world where we scale things and the Fitt's law is a scale invariant law. So we're lucky in a sense. Now, I'm very proud of this work. It got us a Best Paper Award, so I guess other people liked it. Then we looked at things like what happens if I do this, but I change the size of my view. And here we got a very surprising to us result. Now, intuitively, if you're doing this pan and zoom, if you're doing Google Maps, I mean, you've seen these web pages where they give you this thing this big to navigate, right? And what you want is to have it full screen. So obviously, intuitively, there's a factor that has not been accounted for, which is the effect of the size of the view. If I were to do Google Maps on my watch, probably have a harder time than if I did it on my 30-inch screen. So, and that this notion of view size is not present in the basic Fitt's pointing paradigm because you see all the views. So the view, if it's there, it's bigger than the space you operate in, so it doesn't matter. So we did the first experiment where we did the same navigation task as before, but with different view sizes. And the first experiment we ran was like this. We didn't have these points. And we saw no effect of view size. We said that that can't be. So we did the second one with way smaller views than what we had in the first one. And here we started to see the fact that it does collapse at some point. And our surprise is that, well, there are two things. One is the effect of view size was present for views much smaller than what we thought. Now, this is in our experimental paradigm. I believe that if you do this with real maps, you need more context to orient yourself than in the tasks that we had. So the size at which you see the effect of the bandwidth collapsing is probably different depending on the task, but it still was much smaller than what we thought. And the other thing is that we have, in fact, I dare to say, an extension to Fitts' law, where our movement time was proportional at ID divided by the view size. And this is a very strong relationship. I don't have the data here. So this is very good news, because it means that not only we can do pan and zoom navigation on small displays very efficiently, so it's good for your smartphones and things like this, and we also have a fairly strong law to predict the performance and to study the trade-offs. Another work we did on that is OrthoZoom. So here the issue is you're looking at a very long document. So we're not doing a 2D document, we're doing a 1D document. We took all the plays of Shakespeare's. That's, I think, about 50,000 lines. And your task is to find, you know, to be or not to be. Now, when I say to find, I'm cheating. You have to know where it is. Pointing task is not visual search. Pointing task is, you know where it is, you just have to get there as quick as possible. There's a whole set of literature on finding things, searching, visually or otherwise. Here, let's say you know where to be or not to be is, and you have to get there. And we did the system called OrthoZoom, where we said, well, you know, when you scroll, you're only using one dimension, which is vertical, to go back and forth. What if we use the other dimension, hence the term ortho, orthogonal, to control zooming? And so we have an interface where if you go up and down, you scroll. If you go left and right, you zoom in and out. Now, of course, if I zoom out text, after a while I get this thing where it's unreadable, and it gets this sort of gray thing that has no structure. If my information space has no structure, I can't go anywhere. If Google Earth were covered in fog, you would be able to find anything. So what we do is, these texts have structure. There are what is called scenes and acts and plays. So as you move out, as you zoom out, you start seeing the name of the scenes and then the name of the acts. So you have this kind of what we call semantic zooming, where zooming is not a purely visual operation of getting things smaller and bigger. Zooming is basically showing information at different levels of the structure. Text, paragraphs, chapter, scenes, acts, etc. Now, there is another technique, and I don't know if one of you has taken it in, as their project, called speed-dependent automatic zooming, SDAS. No? Yes, you did. Yeah, we exchanged emails. So SDAS is very nice, and essentially what SDAS is this does. The way it works is, when you scroll, it adjusts the level of zoom to the speed at which you're scrolling. So if you scroll faster, it will zoom out for you, and as you slow down, it will zoom in for you. And that was the best technique that was known at the time. And with OrthoZoom, with putting the control of the zoom in the hands of the user, we were able to have something that was twice as fast. Now, I believe that you could reduce this gap by being more clever about the automatic thing. But it's interesting that as a human user, you're better able to adjust the zoom to what you're doing than the system. I don't think this is the end of the story. This is something that can probably be improved. I think I have a short video of SDAS, OrthoZoom. It's one of these things where, again, if you don't manipulate it yourself, it's not necessarily easy to understand or compelling. Well, sorry, Shakespeare is 150,000 lines of text. I thought it was only 50,000. So here is the text. Here I'm moving to the left. I'm zooming out, and you see text disappear and structure appear, the axe. Now I'm moving down with a more or less constant level. Then I sort of zoom back in, and I get detail, and I get the second part of Henry IV. And when you use it, it's kind of, I mean, it's natural. It's like you've seen it, and then you miss it in other systems. So here's to explain how we show what we call the multi-scale table of contents to give you information about what's in there. In fact, you know, when you look at maps, you get the same thing. As you zoom out, the maps, you know, small roads disappear, and you just see the highways, etc., etc. So you already have this semantic zooming for maps, and if you zoom on the satellite imagery, it's a lot harder to find things. So here is another example where, in fact, what it does as well is highlights the closest thing at the next level. So it will snap if you release the button. It will snap to the highlighted part and go to the detail view. Yeah, left and right.
So you grab the scroll bar and then you move on the left to zoom out and...
Yes. And I think I think there's an app on Caroline Appert's website. Okay, and this is the last slide for... No, it's not. Oh, damn. Okay, so we talked about Fitts' law, but there's a whole bunch of other laws. First, Fitts' law is really a 1D law. It's left and right, width, distance. That's it. Now, in real life, we're in a 2D, well, some people will pretend we're in a 3D world, but I think we're in a 2D world, at least on the computer. So 2D pointing, the targets are rectangles. So depending on the angle you come from, things get complicated. You have various variants, and they all somehow work. They all sort of look the same. This is important, but different, is crossing. Crossing is the idea that instead of reaching a target, you are crossing a goal. So this is for pen-based interfaces, where tapping is not very natural, but the idea is that you have a goal and you cross that goal. Shumin Zai and Johnny Akot showed that in fact you have a fixed formulation of this, where the width is in fact the height of the goal here. And this then turned into the steering law, which is a very, very nice piece of work, where they looked at a law to represent traversing a tunnel. So remember when we talked about submenus, I said you have to stay on the tile of the submenu to go down and etc. Well, they've operationalized this, and they found that, for example, for a linear tunnel of constant width, you have movement time is proportional to A over W. The log disappears. And that makes sense, because the longer you have to stay in the tunnel, the harder it is. And you have really, imagine yourself, you're driving in a tunnel, and you don't want to hit the sides of the tunnel. This is what you do here. And they have a general formulation with a curvilinear integral for any trajectory with varying widths, which is a very powerful tool. Going back to the crossing interface, here's a video of... I'm going to find this. Oh, yeah, here it is.
Okay, well, we're not gonna. Doesn't want to do it. So this is a Crossy interface. It's a drawing interface, and everything that you're going to see in a moment is starting to draw. So here it's showing if you don't have crossing, so you spend your time tapping with your pen. And in a moment, like right now, we're going to see the crossing interface. So here, he did one crossing on the left to select both the color and the thickness. And you can see now it's blue with a thicker line. Okay, so that's interesting, but it's not earth-shattering. So here is now a variant for the various menus and various tools. So here is selecting color. Here is selecting the eraser. And here is selecting the pen. Okay, nothing fancy here. Come on, video, move faster. So here, by crossing to the left, he gets a palette, and he can cross through the different values here of thickness and color to have this more fluid interaction. And if you work with a pen on a tablet or on a tablet, you know that it's easier to move your pen along the paper than to keep tapping. There is one part that I like in this video, and this is the find and replace. Oh, here it is. Okay, so here he wants to select some object based on their color, I believe. So this is the find, and you can select by thickness or by color. So again, by crossing, he's going to say I want to select this and this size. And here he's doing a find and a replace by this and that. So in one gesture, he said what to find, what to replace. And then he can change here his mind. And then once this is selected, he can find next, replace, just by turning. Or you can undo by going back, or you can change things. So it's an interesting thing because it's there's no clicking anymore of buttons. It's all done by these fluid trajectories through the different items. So here's doing find, replace, and you can see it happen in real time. Anyway, so that's just to say that there are still ways to think of interaction, especially with pen, with touch, that are different from typical desktop interfaces. And one lesson of this is really about the notion of information. I think we don't understand enough about what is going on in the exchange of information between the system and the user. There is information that we put on the display, which is not necessarily the information that is perceived by the user. So you have this mismatch on the one hand. And on the other hand, there's information that is produced by the motor system, your gesture, and the information that is captured by the system. And here, too, a lot is lost in the middle. A mouse is a very poor device when it comes to capturing subtle gestures. In OrthoZoom, we just added the second dimension because when you interact with a scroll bar, even though you need a 2D control of your motion, only one dimension is used. So if you think in terms of these exchanges of information, and especially waste of information that is available but not perceived, or information that is produced but not captured, then you can increase the bandwidth of the communication between the human and the system, and you can have a system that are more efficient in a way, or allow more expressivity by the user to do more subtle things. Okay, and that is it for that section, and we've all earned a little break. Unless you have questions. Are we going to have questions?
I have a question on the OrthoZoom. Aren't you constraining the users to just move like this or like that? I mean, you could have a mode where they get into this.
I think in terms of the motor control, it could be better, because I think what's happening is when you move vertically, it still takes into account your small horizontal movements, and you see the zooming in and out. So I think there should be a threshold so that horizontal movements should be ignored if you're not moving very much. And so, yeah, there are probably things to improve. Right now, it's really very, very straightforward. The X, Y is mapped to X position and zoom.
Is Wendy here in the moment? This week, is Wendy here?
Yes.
Yeah?
Doesn't this crossing interface rely on tunneling all the time? Tunneling, like... it seems like you had to go in
no.
a small path between the symbols you didn't want to
it,
cross.
It depends a lot on how you do the layout. So it's not real tunneling. The only thing that count is gold passing, because the video is small, but around each of these sort of buttons, there is two little dots up and down, and that defines the goal you have to pass. So you don't have to tunnel through the whole text. It's just passing through the middle.
So if he had
so you can,
diagonal,
yes,
for example,
yeah,
it wouldn't have triggered the goal.
Right. Yeah. And here, it's always a tension. When you show the thing in use, you want to be more careful.
Yeah.
In real use, people get more fluid. So, and whether the goal, a goal of size W is the same as a target of size W. So there's no tunnel in that interface. But you still have to pay attention to how you lay out things to favor some types of trajectories,
yeah,
that are more common. Okay?